Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Center for American Progress. We're about to get started in a couple minutes. Just a quick reminder to please turn off any cell phones or pagers you might have. Also, we're going to have a short question and answer period at the end of the panel. When you ask your question, please stand up, state your name, and state your organization. Thank you.
Have we reached the 12:30 hour? Good afternoon. I'm Jeff Laurenti, Senior Fellow at the Century Foundation in New York. And on behalf of the Century Foundation and our partners and co-hosts at the Center for American Progress, I'd like to welcome you to this afternoon's discussion of the coming crisis with Iran. The religious and revolutionary fervor uncorked by Iranians' overthrow of an American client king a quarter century ago aborted one American presidency, scarred the second term of another, and today poses one of the most awkward challenges to President Bush in a region on which he has chosen to gamble his presidency. Iran is a country that burst on the history stage 2,500 years ago, when it freed Jews in Babylonian captivity to return to the land of Israel, yet whose current president now fulminates against Israel's restoration and even existence. It's a country with some of the world's largest oil reserves, but little oil refining capacity, yet its major energy investment is in the development of nuclear power. And that peaceful nuclear program leaves enough traces of suspicion as to alarm the International Atomic Energy Agency, to say nothing of some of its neighbors and more distant powers. In the spring, the Century Foundation became concerned that on Iran, as on Iraq 4 years ago, the United States seemed headed for a military confrontation without adequate debate about the problem, our options, and their consequences. Century commissioned a series of papers to bring some of the keenest and best-informed minds to bear on core questions regarding Iran. Can Iran be dissuaded from developing a nuclear arsenal by purposeful political engagement? For this, we turn to Flint Leverett at the New America Foundation, whose paper, and who himself, is here. Second, can international sanctions add enough pressure to tilt Tehran's political calculus decisively in favor of strict nuclear control, and can the Security Council muster the will to impose them? For this, we turn to Bruce Gentleson at Duke University, who at the moment is in England, not here, and whose paper will be posted Monday at the Century Foundation website, tcf.org. Third, what's the internal political dynamic that is driving Iran's responses to international calls to secure its nuclear program from weapons temptations. For this, we have turned to Gareth Smith, bureau chief in Tehran for the Financial Times of London, whose paper is also on the TCF.org website. Smith is on the ground in Iran today observing Islamist democracy in action. Fourth, if we can't talk to these people, what kinds of military options could the U.S. deploy to take down Iran's nuclear program or to bring down its Islamic Republic, and what can the military option accomplish? To this question, retired Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner offers some bracing answers in his paper, which, like Sam himself, is here. And fifth, how, if Iranians insist on pressing ahead with nuclear weapons, would that affect security in the region and globally, and what do we do then? Barry Posen of MIT offers a flinty-eyed analysis in his paper, and he and it are here for your delectation. At every step in preparing this program, we at Century benefited from our collaboration with the Center for American Progress, and especially from the energy and insight of its senior vice president, Joe Cirincione. Today's program is, in fact, yet another in a series of joint activities in our ongoing shared initiative exploring issues of security and peace. Finally, we have been very fortunate to enlist one of this country's most celebrated practitioners of the diplomatic arts, Thomas Pickering, to help lead our discussions of these issues, both in the United Nations community and here in Washington today. Tom Pickering, as you all must know, has been the U.S. ambassador to virtually every capital in the world that matters, and probably to some that don't. President Bush appointed him America's permanent representative to the U.N., and even more remarkably, he was confirmed by the Senate, 99-0. He forged diplomatic coalitions inside the U.N. to maintain a solid front to reverse Iraq's attempted annexation of Kuwait, and he has remained close to the region. He now serves as co-chairman of the United Nations Association of the United States. We've asked Tom to lead off our discussion with an overview of what the U.S., Iran, other Security Council members, and other states in the region have at stake in the control of Iran's nuclear program and to sketch out various ways to achieve such control. Joe will then moderate a discussion among our three paper writers and Tom to explore some of these issues in depth for about a half hour, and then we will have about 35 minutes of questions and answers and comments from you, and we will adjourn promptly at 2 p.m. Tom Pickering.
Thank you, Jeff, very much, and fully responsive to my mafia bosses, Laurenti and Cirincione, I am here today to present you with some views on basically my current perceptions of the Iranian program and some thoughts about what we can do to deal with it. I'd like to begin by saying the coming crisis is with us. It certainly, in my view, is serious now. It has every propensity to become more serious, but not quibbling with the title of the presentation, let us begin with a full dark cloud of crisis hovering over us. Very briefly, because I have a limited amount of time, I think almost everyone now agrees that Iran's nuclear program is a program to be seriously concerned about it. If you're not, one of the best published efforts is a review by the International Institute of Strategic Studies, both their 2005 net assessment and an autumn 2006 survival article by Mark Fitzpatrick, which outlines at least a series of important reasons why we should be concerned about it. But we can take satisfaction in an unusual display of solidarity in this day and age. Most of the members of the Security Council agree with that assessment and with the United States on that issue. A principal question is how long it will take Iran to weaponize, which determines a lot about what we can do to deal with the issue. There are differing views. 3 years ago, my Israeli friends told me 2 years. At the moment, I think the DNI has an assessment of several years, perhaps 3 to 5. So you can take your choice in between those. We don't have forever, but I suspect we still have a little bit of time. What do we believe about the major question of sensitive technologies, which I'll touch on a little bit in the future? Without going over it all, I understand that there is now operating in Iran 164-unit centrifuge cascade, and that Ahmadinejad, the president, recently announced a new target of 3,000. I remain concerned, as others do, by Iranian interest in a heavy water reactor, for all that pertains with respect to the plutonium route. What should we be doing about this critically difficult and important program? As usual, there are the three options that government always can come up with to deal with this question. Option number one is to walk away and prepare for regional and world effort to deal with a proliferated Iran, including what I see as the compounding and cascading consequences, the serious potential of having to stop similar programs after Iran in places like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates. Not an attractive option at all, and one where, in a sense, buckling on the preventive activities and buckling on the defensive activities after the fact is an option, in my view, that at the moment is wisely and clearly discarded by almost everyone in sight, despite the fact that Barry is going to tell us exactly how to deal with it in his paper. The second option is the option widely talked about of military attack, using air and special forces and perhaps other choices. I think that we all agree, particularly after the last 2 weeks in Iraq, that a ground attack is less and less likely. This is widely discussed. In my view, it has one serious pro in the pro and con list for it. And the one serious pro is that most people agree we would have in a military attack an opportunity to set the program back for some amount of time. The estimates vary from 2 years and less, depending upon what we know. The cons are numerous and I think very persuasive. There seems to be, at the moment, insufficient intelligence to count on an absolutely clear target set with respect to what would be a series of nuclear targets in Iran, and therefore we might take out the known program but falling back on the retiring defense secretary. What about the unknown, unknown parts of the program? Certainly, an attack on Iran on its nuclear program would create an even more negative perception in the Islamic world against the United States and Israel, and I would probably conclude that were Israel to undertake this attack on its own, the United States would be in much the same way viewed by the rest of the world as a full partner. An Iranian riposte opens up many particular activities, everything from the opportunity to announce after the attack that it really does have nuclear ambitions to defend itself, to the use of terror with which it is practiced, to causing even larger difficulties in Iraq, to using the Hezbollah and other forces to attack Israel through South Lebanon and elsewhere, and a major effort on the part of Iran to unite others, particularly in the Muslim world, against the United States, to more extreme steps, including closing off its own oil exports, something that has threatened closing the Straits of Hormuz, and creating, I think, broader and greater difficulties for the world highly dependent upon that. My own view is that this is an option that is only to be considered seriously after looking at all other options, but not one as a diplomat I would try to take off the table. And indeed, I've often said, were we to try to take it off the table, the present level of distrust between Iran and the United States would not convince the Iranians that it was off the table. The third option is a diplomatic option somewhere between these two. Its main features are to provide the maximum possible in negotiating options of a positive side against the gradual isolation of Iran through sanctions in the Security Council and elsewhere, a mixture of carrots and sticks. I would have four baskets of carrots, and I'll sketch these out very briefly because my time is drawing to a close. The nuclear basket would include everything that Iran believes it needs to conduct a civil nuclear program except enrichment and reprocessing. That would involve the use of a new international fuel regime in which governments apparently are now working, together with what I hope would be an IAEA role in that fuel regime to provide a donor of last resort of fuel on the basis that countries receiving that fuel were complying with their non-proliferation obligations. And my view is this should not be Iran-focused uniquely, but should begin to become the international standard for nuclear fuel provision, for taking back spent fuel, and gradually fill the loophole in this regard in the NPT treaty. It would, in my view, have to be accompanied by very serious and very broadly open inspection possibilities, largely conducted by the IAEA, but perhaps based on UN Security Council Resolution 1441. The other three baskets are very straightforward. A bilateral basket with the United States, the purpose of which would be through direct talks to settle outstanding disputes with the U.S. and to move toward the establishment of full relations. I would hold regime change and use of force on the table in the bilateral discussions to be, in fact, put into the mix at the time we got an appropriate nuclear settlement. But I would certainly be prepared to see those go into return for a nuclear settlement. The third basket is regional security. It would involve nuclear guarantees for all states in the region who are and will remain non-nuclear, as well as a new regional organization or similar arrangement to resolve disputes between states in the region and introduce arms control and disarmament measures. The fourth basket would be essentially an anti-sanctions package to lift sanctions if there were real progress made in negotiations. The sticks would be straightforward: sanctions in the UN Security Council, perhaps at stated intervals of 6 to 9 months, depending upon perceptions of how rapidly Iran was moving toward a nuclear posture, beginning with smart sanctions, moving on to sanctions equivalent to what the U.S. currently has, moving on beyond that to sanctions on trade, except for oil and gas, and finally, at the end of the day, with sufficient time to prepare, sanctions on oil and gas. They would only be put on if diplomacy were not making progress with Iran along these lines. To begin the whole process, I would start talks without preconditions, both multilaterally and bilaterally between the United States and Iran. But I would make the first item of business what I would call a double freeze, a freeze on Iranian enrichment and a freeze on sanctions at the UN and elsewhere. This might be time-limited, but it would give the opportunity for the process to begin. Very briefly, as you all know, the European three in the Security Council, France, Britain, and Germany, have joined the United States in this effort and work closely to try to achieve progress with Iran in negotiations. Russia and China have been very hesitant in sanctions, particularly sanctions up front, and persuading them with this kind of a package would be a formidable diplomatic task, but one I believe that is important to take on. I believe the other members of the Security Council could be brought along. But let me end there, and I look forward to the discussion led by you, Joe, and with which the others will participate. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Ambassador Pickering. That was a terrific opening and overview of the situation. I want to start talking to our panelists about how they see the problem. I want to start with you, Flint, because you've been working this issue for many years, first in government and then out of government, and you argue in your paper that what we need is a comprehensive and strategically coherent diplomatic approach to Iran. That's something that experts love to argue for and politicians hate to try to implement. What makes you think that this approach would work?
It's not just that I think this approach would work. It's that I think this is the only approach to diplomacy with Iran that might work. I talk about a grand bargain, a process aimed at an outcome in which all of the outstanding bilateral differences between the U.S. and the Islamic Republic are resolved in a package. That approach starts with an assessment that Iran is not going to compromise on any of the significant concerns we have about their behavior without what I call a security guarantee, essentially a commitment not to use force to change the borders of the form of government of the Islamic Republic. When I appear in public with Iranian officials, they don't like that phrase. They say, we don't need a security guarantee. They prefer rhetoric like they need U.S. acceptance of the Islamic Republic, but I think in practical terms, it's the same thing. Given all of the baggage between the United States and Iran, I don't think that there's any U.S. administration of either party that can put a security guarantee on the table unless we not only get our concerns about Iran's nuclear activities addressed, but also their links to terrorist groups, groups that we consider terrorist organizations, their attitude
Hezbollah in Lebanon,
Hamas, their attitude toward the Arab-Israeli conflict, and so on. And that means from the Iranian side, we're also going to have to be putting our sanctions on the table, the prospect of normalized relations with the United States. And that takes you into a grand bargain. I think, frankly, at this point, you can't resolve any of the outstanding bilateral differences between the U.S. and Iran without resolving all of the significant.
Well, you argue this very well in your paper, and I find this very compelling, but many expert groups have argued for exactly the opposite, and you take issue with this.
Yes.
Some would say the incremental approach. And in particular, you disagree with the Council on Foreign Relations study from 2004, whose co-chairman, Robert Gates, is now our Secretary of Defense. And they argued for taking a smaller bite of the apple. What's wrong with that?
It sounds very prudent and reasonable, and it is the kind of thing that wise men groups like Council on Foreign Relations Task Forces come up with. It's unfortunate. It's just not going to work, and it ignores a 20-year history of U.S. administrations pursuing precisely this kind of limited issue-specific engagement with Iran. We did it in Lebanon. We did it in Bosnia after the 9/11 attacks. We did it in Afghanistan. And on each occasion, I would argue, it is the U.S. administration that has let either domestic politics or other foreign policy interests torpedo that cooperation. The Iranians are kind of, it's a little bit like Lucy in the football with Charlie Brown. They're not going to go down this road again.
Let me talk to you specifically about this, because this is something that former Secretary of State Baker talked about as part of the Baker-Hamilton report, that they're recommending that the U.S. engage Iran and do it in the same way that we engaged Iran over the Afghan war.
Mm-hmm.
You were involved in that process, am I right?
I was in government at the time, that's right.
Tell me about that.
Yes, essentially, I think that, again, is a really misplaced analogy. After the 9/11 attacks, Iranian officials believed they had a unique opportunity to try and put their relationship with the United States on a better trajectory. They thought that the 9/11 attacks were such both a tragedy and a strategic challenge for us that if they helped us respond to those attacks, that it would prompt a change in our attitude toward them. And that's why they offered to help us get rid of the Taliban and to stand up a post-Taliban political order in Afghanistan without requiring any change in our policy stance toward them.
And we had direct negotiations with them. Would you call them negotiations?
Yeah,
dialogue?
I would. We had regular meetings. Between U.S. officials and Iranian officials, nominally under the rubric of the 6+2 process at the U.N. These went on
October, November, December,
yes,
2001.
And indeed they went on even after the Iranians were rewarded for their help at the Bonn conference in December 2001 by being labeled part of the Axis of Evil 6 weeks later. The Iranians continued to come to the meetings and to work with us on approaches to try and stabilize post-Taliban Afghanistan, and deal with related issues.
But we ended those talks in May.
In May of 2003, we cited some reports which were never substantiated, to the best of my knowledge, that Iran may have somehow been involved in the May 12, 2003 bombings in Riyadh. And for that reason, we cut off the dialogue. 6 months later, Secretary of State Armitage was telling the Congress we would be prepared to resume.
Now, just before we broke off those talks, in April 2003, they tabled a proposal.
Yes.
How seriously do you take that proposal? And is that the kind of thing you're talking about? Was this kind of let's settle all our differences approach?
The proposal that came in late April of 2003 was indeed, I would characterize it as a proposal to begin negotiating a grand bargain. It laid out a set of issues that Iran would have to be prepared to address. It laid out a set of issues that the U.S. would need to be prepared to address. And it made some suggestions about process, how to get this kind of process started. It was presented as having been approved by all of the major power centers in Iran. I certainly could not guarantee that was the case. I've become ever more persuaded since I left government and talked with more and more Iranian officials that was indeed the case, but it was something we would have needed to explore. But we didn't even bother to explore that option. We simply rejected it out of hand and, in fact, complained to the Swiss Foreign Ministry that the Swiss ambassador in Tehran, who had passed this paper, was exceeding his brief by half doing so.
Let me turn to Colonel Gardner here, because the reason we rejected that is that we weren't interested in negotiating with this regime. The view was we could overthrow the entire regime. You remember in the spring and summer of 2003, the Iraq war was going well, and there was a feeling that we could just run the table. You know, next stop, Tehran, Damascus, we could do it. It didn't work out that way. You know, and the balance has now shifted. The Iranians, I believe, think that they're growing stronger and we're growing weaker in the region. And as a result of the November elections, that the military option might be completely off the table, that we can't actually afford to attack them, and that they've lost the will to do that. How do you see that, Sam?
Wrong. No, I would even disagree with the ambassador a little bit. The military option is not on the table, probably inappropriate to say. The military option is on the vice president's desk. That is not normal military planning. Plans don't go to the executive branch until things are getting close. I don't think the election has affected that. There is, what I have done most of is try and explain how the administration has got where I think they are. And there are about seven truths they hold as self-evident. One of them, that Iran is developing nuclear weapons. That's probably true. The second is that Iran ignores the international community on a lot of things. Clearly, that's true. Iran supports Hezbollah and Hamas. Got that. That's true. Iran is increasingly inserting itself in Iraq and more in Afghanistan. Certainly true. The people of Iran want a regime change. Probably not. And the final assumption is that sanctions are not going to work, and they believe that to be true. And sort of once you go through those seven truths and you can't negotiate with these people, you're left with the military option not on the table but on the vice president's desk.
Wait a minute. On the vice president's desk. What does that mean?
Well, let me be specific on, no, literally from press reports, good journalists, we know that the military have done their thing with the plan, and the plan has gone to the vice president's office.
Wait a minute, but the plan, sure. You have plans for lots of things.
Right.
You're saying this is different.
This is different. Plans don't go to the vice president as a normal course.
So your view would be there's at least a faction of the administration that wants to attack Iran.
Yes, clearly. And I think there are a couple parts of it we have to understand. One of them is, and again, I would disagree with the ambassador, we got to remember And we've been told this in a number of books that have been released about the administration thinking. This is not about the Iranian nuclear program alone. In fact, that may be just the cover, as it was in Iraq, for other things. This is about the Iranian involvement in Iraq. Talk more and more about that recently. It's about the Iranian support of Hezbollah. I would argue, even if we found a solution to the Iranian nuclear enrichment, we would still find the administration not be willing to go down that road. Because, and as we know from things written about the way the vice president thinks, when anybody attacks the United States, Iran has done that in numbers of cases. They're doing that right now in Iran. They have to be punished, or others will follow and do the same thing. So I think this is clearly top of the list.
Let's follow that out. Could we do it? What does that military option look like? You've war gamed this. You did a number of war games, both professionally, in service and out of service, and you did the most famous of which was the series you did for the Atlantic Monthly with James Fallows. That was 2 years ago now. What do you think the plan looks like now? If we were to push it, what would we do?
One of the reasons why the option is relatively attractive is because it's easy to do. It's not an invasion. It's not the kind of thing that people had talked about at one time. It's not certainly like Thunder Run to Baghdad. What we read about is that it's probably 4 or 5 nights, I say nights, of attack on the facilities in Iran. Nights, I say that because it will be done with cruise missiles and B-2 bombers. Very few penetrations of Iranian airspace, and I would bet the president has been advised very low casualties, or no casualties. Am I starting to make it sound attractive? It will punish Iran. Now, Clinton said we can't invest it. We don't know where the targets are. We don't know the unknowns. But if you understand the objective is to punish Iran, not just deal with the nuclear program, you don't need to know where the targets are, because it is the purpose of showing you can't treat the United States this way. And one of the arguments, I think it's going to become more and more apparent, because we are going to see more and more stuff released about the Iranian involvement in Iraq. And it will start with that argument that they are the part of the problem we have there now. They are. But it's going to become more and more apparent, and the pressure is going to grow to put that out.
So we do that. We do, let's say, if it comes to this, we do 5 nights. You've talked about 750 aim points. The problem is what happens next. Ambassador Pickering was talking about this. What do the Iranians do on day 6?
The Iranians have a notion that really, I'm sure they wouldn't use this word, but that goes back to the Cold War, which is what we used to call horizontal escalation. In other words, if you can't take on the bad guys directly, you take them on in an indirect way. We couldn't take on the Soviets in Central Europe, so the idea was you went to the northern flank. Their concept of this kind of deterrence and this kind of attack is that you begin to threaten American interests other places. They're not going to put down any bombers. And the idea of that would be, and I think here is the most serious one for us to deal with, which would be a series of low visibility, low signature. You know, you can't find the DNA is necessarily Iran, attacks on U.S. interests in the region and outside the region. Just to give you an example, the connection between Iran and Muqtada al-Sadr could lead one to conclude that the Facilities Protection Service in Iraq could target the both north and southern oil lines. 2 million barrels off the market almost immediately. Was it Iran that did that, or was it part of the normal insurgency in Iraq? Can't say. All of a sudden, some facilities in the Gulf Cooperation Council states are blown up. Was it Iran, or was it somebody else? A whole range of things that make it more difficult for the United States to stay in the region, more difficult for American public to support our presence in Iraq, but still a significant retaliation.
Dr. Posen, let me turn to you about this. When I hear Ambassador Pickering and Colonel Gardner talk about it, the military option looks very unattractive to me. Is that how it strikes you?
Yeah, it strikes me as quite unattractive, and it strikes me as unattractive because I've not heard of a military option that's been offered that takes away from the Iranians the ability to do things on the scale that Sam was just mentioning, or on a greater scale. And, you know, we have 150,000 troops in Iraq. Much of their line of communication runs up the Iranian border through areas where the Iranians have friends. We're barely able to master the situation in central Iraq, where we're dealing with perhaps, you know, 5 million Sunni insurgents and 5 million other people who don't like us much. I wouldn't like to see what this world looks like, and I don't think the president would either. It could put a very significant new requirement for us for ground forces just for security purposes in the theater, and we're already pretty stretched. This doesn't look very attractive to me.
So in your Century Foundation paper, you go through this a bit, you argue that, and then you also say, well, what if the negotiations don't work? What if we can't stop the Iranian program? And your conclusion is that in the end, if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, that we could live with that. We could live with an Iran with a nuclear weapon the same way we've lived with China with a nuclear weapon for almost 40 years. Am I summarizing your argument correctly?
That's correct. You always have to be careful in laying out arguments like this so it doesn't sound like don't worry, be happy. My preference would be for one of these diplomatic possibilities to come to fruition, but that's not really my stock in trade. I'm comparing the possibilities of a strategy of containment and deterrence versus a strategy of preventive war, and the preventive war strategies just don't look that good to me. So it forces you to start thinking through the problem of containment and deterrence. And it's in some ways it ought to be easier than containing China or containing the Soviet Union. In other ways, it might be a little more difficult. But it's worth remembering that the United States is vastly more powerful than Iran. I mean, Iran's influence in the Gulf region may be growing, but this is a country of 70 million people. It's a one-crop country. Its crop is oil. It's got only an intermediate to low technological base, and it's got fairly obsolescent conventional forces. So this is a country that doesn't have all that many options. So the United States has the power to engage in containment and deterrence. We have strong interests in the region, so I think our will is probably as strong as they are. The question comes down to whether regional allies want you to help them contain and deter Iran.
Okay, so here's my problem, though. Iran develops this program over time.
Mm-hmm.
I think the intelligence estimate is 5 to 10 years.
Yes.
But the official national intelligence estimate, which the Congress has asked to update this year, is that somewhere in the next decade they probably could get this capability. You say we could deter them from using the bomb, and I think that's true. I think deterrence is alive and well, and that we could contain them. What about the reaction of the other states in the region? What does Saudi Arabia do? What does Egypt do? What do the Gulf states do if Iran actually gets a nuclear weapon or is perceived to be inevitably on the path to getting a nuclear weapon?
Well, we have a very old discussion about this in international relations theory. It's about whether states typically balance or whether they typically bandwagon. And most of the evidence suggests that states are very interested in preserving their sovereignty, their autonomy, their power, their freedom of action. And if they have a chance to balance against a possible aggressor or threat, they'll take it. Now, sometimes very small states will sign up with the aggressor because they have no alternative. But these states in the Gulf will have an alternative, and the alternative will be the United States of America because of its interest there. And I think it's quite likely that they will sign up. I mean, the noises we're hearing from the Arab states in the Gulf now are not bandwagon noises. The noises we're hearing from the Arab states in the Gulf is, we need you Americans to contain the Iranians. We're ready to sign up. Where are you? So I don't have a lot of fear that the Arab states are going to jump on the Persian bandwagon.
No, it's the other fear. We've heard Jamal Mubarak, the son of Hosni Mubarak, the president of Egypt, just in September said, you know, Egypt needs a nuclear power program. And in October, he articulated a goal of 6 to 8 nuclear reactors. Turkish officials have talked about a nuclear power program. And just last week, the Gulf Cooperation Council, those 6 states, said that they are considering a nuclear power program. Now, let's get clear. There are no nuclear power reactors right now in the Middle East or Africa, except for the one being built in Bushehr in Iran and 2 that South Africa has in Cape Town. So this is a brand new phenomenon. Suddenly, in the last 3 months, there's interest in nuclear power programs. I got to believe that they're interested in something besides electricity on this. Isn't that something that we can't contain, a process that's already happening?
No, I think that's wrong. It seems to me that the propensity of other states to get nuclear weapons in a situation like this depends very much on their security calculations. So therefore, I think the propensity depends very much on what the United States does. I mean, the South Koreans flirted with nuclear programs. The Taiwanese flirted with nuclear programs. One of the reasons they didn't go down this road is because they had an American ally who was there and interested in the politics of their regions. So I think we can have some influence over this. And then the question becomes, what do we want to have happen in these states? These states have various relationships with us that are going to be effective if they decide to become nuclear weapon states. Turkey's a member of NATO. It has access to a nuclear deterrent and, let's be honest, nuclear weapons today. Turkey has an interest in getting into the European Union. That's turned into a rocky road, but it's going to be a lot rockier if they go this way.
Right.
The entire Egyptian military is basically a dependency of the American Security Assistance Program. That's going to go away if they decide to become a nuclear weapon state. The Saudis would face an enormous window between when they decided to start a nuclear program and when they would have a nuclear weapon. And all that time, they would need to be defended by somebody, which would be us. We have leverage over all these people, and I presume we would try and use this leverage. And in the past, we've been successful using this kind of leverage.
Flint, I saw you taking some notes on that. What do you think about the Saudi interest in these kinds of weapons? And do they actually have to develop them themselves?
I would pick up something that Barry said about Saudi calculations. I mean, the way I looked at what the Saudis are doing right now is, I think Barry is right in that, in the kind of environment we're talking about, what the United States would do, how credible its representations would be to a state like Saudi Arabia would be critical. But what I see the Saudis doing now is pursuing a variety of hedging strategies against essentially the U.S. no longer playing the kind of role in the region that it's played for several decades. And this is wrapped up with what I see as a bigger decline in American standing, American hegemony, if you will, in the Middle East. And, I agree with Barry that one of the way the consequences of Iranian nuclearization are contingent on a lot of things. One of the most important things they're contingent on is how the United States deals with Iran, deals with the issues of Gulf security. Right now, the Saudis are hedging their bets about how the United States would deal with it.
I want to bring Ambassador Pickering into this. Do you see it that way? I know you've been talking quite a bit with senior diplomats both in the region and at the UN Security Council. Do you think our regional allies are starting to recalculate the commitment of the United States to the region and its ability to contain events there?
They're two separate pieces, but they're interrelated, Joe, and I think in both cases they are. I think that one would have to be blind to say that our popularity in the region and indeed our standing in the region has risen in the last 5 or 6 years. It's almost axiomatic, and therefore the degree of trust at the public level, maybe not at the private level among officials, has gone down, but I suspect this is also reflected in official attitudes as well. Secondly, you take the case of Saudi Arabia. When it was concerned about missiles in the region, it went to China. There's some indication it may be going back to China. When it's concerned about weapons in the region, it may not think that a homegrown Saudi gaseous diffusion plant would be the answer, but it might mean that their friends in Pakistan would enter into some kind of sharing arrangement. Who knows? There are all those possibilities, and that would be a quick route to a weapon.
Yeah.
And the U.S. reaction to the Chinese missiles in Saudi Arabia might, for them, be the precedent to determine that, well, we would have no alternative also but to defend the oil, to be their friends, but to ignore their sudden sharing arrangement with Pakistan, if I could put it that way. And so I think that these are all possibilities. I tend to agree that we should do everything possible to deal with Iran, and I accept the fact that my friend Barry agrees with that, but that he was asked to do the paper.
Right.
He was asked to do the paper, what happens when it fails. So don't blame him for failure.
Yeah.
But say, in fact, that he's thought about what's the best set of arrangements we should come up with.
Right.
I suggested regional security arrangements, and I think regional security arrangements may be based on the notion that the permanent five members of the Security Council jointly and separately would give guarantees to states in the region against threats and blackmail, as well as nuclear assurances in the event of use, which are already there, would be helpful, because it would only ensure states that don't go nuclear on the one hand, but secondly, it would transcend Iran's crossing the nuclear boundary. It's something we could do now that would have relationships and maybe vitality down the road.
Let me ask you one other question, Ambassador, and then I'm going to give everyone a chance to say a final comment before we open it up for discussion. One of the arguments we hear a lot is that we can't negotiate with these people, that Ahmadinejad has no interest in making a deal with the United States, that this is all going well from his point of view. He's rising in popularity, he's consolidating his domestic political base, and in fact, Iran's fortunes are rising in the region. Do you think that there's some elements inside Iran who are willing to make a deal?
Well, I think the answer to that is yes. First, Ahmadinejad doesn't represent all of Iran. As we know, there's a power structure in which the president is relatively down the hierarchy, not up the hierarchy. Admittedly, Ahmadinejad has spent a lot of time and effort becoming the new star of the Muslim world, and as a result has threatened the people in the power structure.
Yeah.
And so Henry Kissinger used to say, even paranoids have enemies. Well, even Ahmadinejad inside Iran has enemies. Secondly, we have seen feelers. I mean, the history of this relationship has been, when Iran wants to talk, the United States has no interest. And when the United States wants to talk, Iran has no interest. We may be coming to the time when those curves will actually cross over, and it will be of common interest. So my feeling is, yes, there are agreements that are possible and negotiable.
Okay, so here's the tough part. One of the agreements that's possible and out there is what the Iranians are basically offering now. We will suspend our enrichment activity for a limited period of time, a few months, if we know two things, that you're serious about talking to us, and at the end of that period, we can restart the enrichment again, that we're not going to do an indefinite suspension anymore. And then they argue we should be able to find some framework where Iran can do enrichment activity on its soil. Perhaps it's a pilot facility of, they say, the 164 or 300, 500 centrifuges under international inspection, or maybe it's a multinational facility. Would you be willing to make that deal? Would you be willing to let Iran do research on enrichment, that is, continue to spin centrifuges?
The two pieces in your challenge to
me. I was trying to make it one piece.
Go. Let me just say this. If you open talks, you have the opportunity of persuading them to another conclusion. Let me put that aside. Let me address your issue.
Okay.
Your issue is there a situation in which some enrichment is done on Iranian soil that might be acceptable? And I don't know the answer to that, but it is to me preferable, in effect, to have the kind of inspection system present in Iran that I would postulate in as strong a set of guarantees as you can get that it would stay. Even, in fact, if you had a small amount of R&D-type enrichment going ahead. And I could see ways to minimize the long-term impact of the R&D-type enrichment on the one hand, because large-scale cascade operation, the technology people tell me, is really the important part of finding a way to acquire that sensitive technology. On the other hand, the alternative, no inspection and maybe some or no enrichment because you have no inspection, you wouldn't know, is probably a more uncertain alternative.
Thank you. I would like to invite you to make any comments, starting with Dr. Posen, something you wanted to say we didn't get a chance to say, or comment directly on that possible compromise.
Well, I just make one observation. Often in these conversations, all the uncertainties and risks in the conversation are put on the person or put on the argument that says, we should try something different, or we may have to try something different. And then there's another positive solution that is somehow completely certain. So when we talk about a military action against Iran, it's often made to seem like a certain solution where you know what's going to happen, and the boil is lanced, and either you buy yourself 2 years or 3 years or 4 years or forever, but you get something that you understand. Whereas in a strategy like mine, there's a lot of things that you're gonna have to maneuver with, you're gonna have to deal with, you're gonna have to negotiate, you're gonna have to organize, you're gonna have to take some risks, and there are risks, right? But I think people should not be under the illusion that attacking Iran is as simple as lancing a boil. And just the second thing I would remind people of is that Iran is not a superpower. Right? And that's pretty obvious, but when we talk about containment and deterrence versus Iran, we're talking about a rather small state compared to the tough customers that the United States and its allies have dealt with in the past. So there's no reason to start a project like this with a very high degree of pessimism. It seems to me that the reverse is true. The Iranians probably shouldn't want to get themselves into a position where we're thinking about them in containment and deterrence terms, and I hope someone can explain that to them.
Colonel Gardner?
I just want to, and I guess it sort of builds from your comments, which is the notion that I fear we sometimes, with bad analysis, get ourselves into the notion that leads to bad policy. And what I want to add to the discussion is the time frame. You know, if you accept 5 or 10 years to a weapon that you mentioned, Joe, well, we have to remind ourselves that even after the first test, they do not have a nuclear power. You know, remember the Fat Man, which was the U.S. first nuclear weapon that was carried on a B-36? Iran doesn't have B-36s. Their apparent chosen methodology is to be missiles. To engineer a nuclear weapon to withstand the vibrations of missile launch and to go through that kind of trajectory is very difficult. So even when we say we're 5 to 10 years away from a weapon, you probably need to add to that 5 or 10 years more before they have a deliverable weapon that gets to the point where people like Israel have to be afraid. And I used to say, one of my students said this once, which is probably the most profound thing, real men don't need nuclear weapons. Now, the reason that's important is because we fear that line, but it's important to understand what's on the other side of it. For some years, I did nuclear targeting with NATO. We used to put 5 weapons on a Warsaw Pact air base to be 80% certain of destruction. That means assuming launch failures and all that. So, you know, we get caught up in this existential threat to Israel. How many weapons would they need to threaten Israel's existence? Hundreds. Anyway, I would argue the time frame is not as critical as some would.
Thanks. Flint.
Thanks. I think I was able to put out my basic ideas on how we need to be engaging Iran diplomatically, and they're expounded on at greater length in the paper. I wanted to say something briefly about the administration and where it is. I have been extremely pessimistic that this administration is inclined or capable of genuinely rethinking its approach to Iran in the way that we need it to at this point. And I've had an unfortunate experience this week that has only confirmed that for me. As I do with all of my publications, this Century Foundation paper I showed to the CIA, for whom I used to work, for them to verify that I wasn't revealing classified information. They did so, as they have with 30 other things that I've published since leaving government, didn't ask to change a word. I prepared an op-ed for the New York Times off of this paper, which is ready to go, ready for publication. The CISA says, as far as they're concerned, there's not any classified information in it, but the White House has intervened. claiming that there is classified information in the op-ed, even though it's already been cleared. It's all published. It's all based on stuff that Secretary Powell, Secretary Rice, Deputy Secretary Armitage have talked about publicly. It's been extensively reported in the media. But the White House is saying, I can't publish an op-ed in the New York Times that lays out these arguments. I've been doing this for 3.5 years since leaving government, and it really I've never had to, go to the White House to get clearance for something that I was publishing, as long as the CIA said, yeah, you're not putting classified information. Why this week, after the Baker Study Group, when pressure's on them to rethink their position on Iran, why do they not want this op-ed based on my experiences in government, my experiences dealing with Iran, with Iranian officials after I left government? Why do they not want this op-ed going in the New York Times this week? I think it says something, and I think it says something about just how low people like Elliot Abrams at the NSC will stoop to try and limit the dissemination of arguments critical of the administration's policy.
Wow. I have a bunch of questions to ask you about that. But I promised Jeff that I would.
Can I get my turn?
You certainly can, Ambassador.
Yeah, thank you. I wanted just to address one point that Sam made. It seems to me that if the intent of a military attack is to, quote, punish Iran, that the kind of moral inappropriateness of that is matched by a singular lack of focus on the major question that we're trying to deal with here today, which is the Iran nuclear program.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And one wonders whether, in fact, that's the case. If it is, it certainly shows a little serious sense of defining priorities. Others have said, in fact, in the same breath, about the same set of issue, that it really is a effort to use a much broader attack to take down as much of Iran's defensive capabilities as possible, which is a little different than punish, but still in the same category, if, in fact, you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there kind of thing.
Yes, in
Iran. And I wonder, because the consequences of an attack are serious enough and, in my view, potentially difficult enough for the U.S. to face, that we should go ahead and face them on the basis of such serious slipshod thinking about what it is we're trying to do is very, very worrying, because it looks like the kind of same crowd that brought Iraq is still basically in charge of all of our thinking about where we go on Iran.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Thank you, Ambassador. Thank you. And with that, I'm going to pass it over to Jeff Lorente, and in so doing, I want to thank Jeff personally and the Century Foundation for their cooperation with the Center for American Progress. This has been a great joint effort, and I look forward to continuing with you on this in the new year. Thank you, Jeff.
Well, thank you very much, Joe, for having navigated this panel through the shoals of this Iranian issue over the past 35 minutes, and for being so punctual and turning this over to questions and answers. You have made the trains run on time. Now we will take questions, and we'll take three questions together so that the panel will have a multiplicity of ideas to respond to. Starting here, if you could give your name and affiliation.
And wait for the microphone.
Before you have it.
Jay Bonstingel, Bonstingel Leadership Development, Columbia, Maryland. Colonel Gardner and the other panelists, if it is indeed so that real men don't need nuclear weapons, then it brings to our attention the question, what kind of a man is the president of Iran, and how is he reading the ISG report right now?
Okay, towards the back. Just wait for the mic to arrive. And try again.
Yeah, my name is Dr. Masood. I'm a working journalist based in Dubai and also part of a think tank over there. And probably one of the very few people here who was in Iran last week. Just one comment. 5 years back, Iran had two worst enemies in that area, Taliban and Saddam Hussein. And the best thing which American did was for Iran, not for themselves. So both the enemies of Iran are no more there. The question is, I just want to ask, what is the level of cooperation between Americans, NATO forces, and Iranians in Afghanistan? Because Iranians, they claim that they help you, the Americans and the NATO forces, in Afghanistan because both of you have common enemy, and that is Taliban. So what is the level of cooperation, and how? And the other thing is that both the Iranians supported ministers like Ismail Khan. He's part of the Karzai government. And again, the Iranian-backed ministers are there in Iraqi government.
Okay.
So what is this cooperation in Afghanistan?
What is the cooperation? Okay. And to the front here, the gentleman with the blue suit.
Yes, thank you. I'm Norman Birnbaum from the editorial board of The Nation. First of all, I want to thank the panel for, I think I speak for many people, for quite an extraordinarily informative and analytic performance. And I want to thank our hosts for the long list of so-called experts on Iran they didn't invite. And I can't resist, as somebody who does a bit of editing, suggesting to Mr. Leverett that he get the Times to publish a couple of blank columns, and then with the footnote suggestion that the White House would be glad to supply further information. It was done in parts of Eastern, as Ambassador Pickering knows, it was done in parts of Eastern Europe under loose totalitarian regimes. So it would seem to be a useful precedent. But my question is this. Would the panel, any member of the panel or member of the panel, care to comment on the inhibiting or other effects of the United States alliance with Israel on the flexibility or adaptability of our policy towards Iran in the light of President Carter's recent sortie? It doesn't seem an entirely irrelevant question.
Okay, thank you, Norm. So I'm including Joe as part of this panel for answering the questions. We have Jay's on what kind of man is Ahmadinejad. He wants nukes. Mr. Massoud, what level of cooperation between U.S. and Iranian officials is going on even now vis-a-vis Afghanistan? And Mr. Birnbaum's on the inhibiting effects of U.S. alliance with Israel. So if I may start with Ambassador Pickering to pick any or all and go down
the
comments.
Let me take the traditional hard one and talk about the alliance with Israel. I would say a couple of things. There are plenty of books ready to be written about that alliance and where it has constrained both sides and how. On the question of Iran, my feelings from a recent trip to Israel is that I found little enthusiasm for an Israeli airstrike among Israelis and indeed some in leadership circles. Maybe they thought the U.S. would do it for them and that it would be easier if that was the case. They certainly expressed the view that if the U.S. were ready to do it, they wouldn't have to. And I think that that is important. Secondly, I also got out of the same set of conversations, not universally, the notion that if there was some method short of an airstrike, although they doubted it, that should be tried as a way to try to deal with this issue. I suppose it's not revealing secrets that between 1985 and 1988, I dealt with then Defense Minister Rabin on almost weekly, sometimes biweekly meeting occasions. On at least three occasions, I can remember Rabin in that time period saying, please tell your government that you should open conversations with Iran. It's an extremely important country. It's somebody that you should be talking to. In the long run, it's going to be a vital interest for both of us that you establish that relationship and open those conversations.
Flint.
I wanted to say, just to amplify Tom's remarks about the Israel factor. My read of the Israeli national security community is that, on the whole, they're more willing to take what I would call a realist approach to Iran than the United States is. The Israeli national security community basically thinks this administration's attachment to regime change in Iran is not just illusory, but counterproductive. They are, of course, extremely skeptical about Iran's intentions and posture toward Israel, as they are certainly justified in being. But that being said, if we were able to negotiate the kind of grand bargain that I've described, that I've laid out in my paper, that the Iranians themselves proposed negotiating with us in the spring of 2003, if we were able to negotiate a grand bargain like that that addressed serious security concerns for Israel as well as for the United States, the Israelis would want to look at every detail in the fine print to make sure there weren't any loopholes. But if the agreement was really addressing these concerns, they would not stand in its way. They are, in the end, more realist about this than we have been so far.
Can we get someone to step to the plate on the kind of man as Ahmadinejad and U.S. Iran and Afghanistan?
Okay, let me do the nuclear weapon thing. And again, this, the analysis ends up, if we don't do the analysis, we don't end up with good policy. Nuclear weapons have very little military value. And if you spend a little time talking to military guys who have thought about it, you'll find that. You take a room like this and say, anybody here think the United States ought to have nuclear weapons? A room full of military guys, there would be very few hands for the military value of nuclear weapons. There is a political value. You can't discount that. The military value for Iran of nuclear weapons probably is limited to preventing regime change. You know, you can envision a scenario, whether it be the United States or somebody else, or Iraq, invading Iran, and that massed force being a wonderful target, wonderful as in politically used on your own soil against an attacking enemy. Beyond that, it is pretty difficult to find a military use for nuclear weapons. And I think there is, you know, one of the things we might be doing better than screaming about this firebreak is helping Iranian people, generals, understand that limitation. And it might not be unlike what I understand Secretary Armitage did with the Pakistanis. And I'm told that he went to Pakistan and said, here, let us show you the results of some war games we have done, and here is the consequence of an exchange between India and Pakistan. Now, should we try and work things out in Kashmir? I think there's a lot to that, and that really is, once you go on the other side and explore what happens when you do have nuclear weapons, there is some wisdom that adds to that.
Talking about wisdom, any wisdom on the question of current U.S.-Iran cooperation?
Yeah, I really don't have any other than, you know, what one reads in the press, which is, the Iranian involvement in development projects, particularly in the West, is very high. You know, they have seriously taken on the notion of becoming involved there. I hear some press people that they may be stirring up things in other places, but I don't have any evidence of that.
Can I just add to the nuclear answer? I just want to disagree a little with Sam. I think historically countries get nuclear weapons for three basic reasons. It's power, it's prestige, and it's politics. And the power is usually security, and this is the one that Sam's talking to. Iran probably is interested in at least having a nuclear weapon option for security purposes, to prevent attacks on them, to preserve their regime. So any strategy that's going to convince Iran not to develop nuclear weapons has got to address security interest and have a better guarantee of their security than they would otherwise get from a nuclear weapon. The other is prestige. India is a case in point. France is a case in point. They want it because it's a shortcut to great power status. Iran sees itself as the natural hegemon in the region. They believe that getting a nuclear weapon will enhance that. So any solution to convince them not to has got to address their legitimate security interest in the region and find a framework for involving them in a way that they couldn't be involved if they had nuclear weapons. And finally, it's politics. domestic political actors have a much greater role in the decisions, in the country's decision to get nuclear weapons than most people realize. There are factions inside Iran, just as there are factions inside every country. Ahmadinejad has used this issue brilliantly to popularize an otherwise unpopular government. So we have to have a strategy that takes this issue away from him, that exposes him as the corrupt and incompetent politician that, that he really is, and allows his government to fall because they can't deliver on what most Iranians want, which is economic prosperity and political plurality. So we've got to devise a strategy that takes this away, isolates him, and appeals more to the pragmatists, I wouldn't call them moderates, but the pragmatists in the rest of the Iranian political structure.
Thank you, Joe. All right, question right up here. That's the wall. And the microphone is arriving.
My name's Jim Atwood. I'm a retired Presbyterian minister. And it's my understanding that we have a program in the United States called Stockpile Stewardship, where we maintain our nuclear weapons, of which we have 10,000. The other nuclear states also have thousands of nuclear weapons. And they had an agreement a few years ago that they would begin to dismantle them. However, no progress has been made. I remember the comment that the late William Sloan Coffin made when he said, "Here we are with 10,000 nuclear weapons, like the world's largest chain smoker, telling another nation which doesn't have any that they should not begin to smoke. And we will see to it that they don't smoke." It seems to me that this is that we have a very high opinion of our own virtue and our own wisdom in dealing with these horrible weapons that we have. And I think we have to address that question before any of the others can have any credibility.
Okay. Question here. Question.
Good afternoon. Before I raise my question, my name is Ahura Piruz Yazdi. I'm the president of Hakka Movement. Hakka Movement for Freedom and Democracy. This movement exists 2,564 years since Cyrus the Great, known to all of you. It was painful for me and all Iranians to hear whenever you want to talk about mullahs or Islamic regime, you mention Iranians. Sir, gentlemen, Iranians are Persians. They do not speak Arabic. They are not Islamic. Their country has been invaded by a group of mullahs, non-Iranian. My people are hostage. And
okay,
today you are...
Okay, I asked you the question.
Okay, the question is, 70% of my people are young people, non-Islamic. They are ready to regime change. The question is, why United States doesn't support Persian Iranian people who want regime change and want to get rid of these mullahs as soon as possible? Last 6 days, they showed again another demonstration all over Iran. And as a matter of fact, I called on my TV station twice.
Now we understand, Mr. Puruziasti, your question, and we'll go on now to the one in the back.
Hi, Miles Pomper from Arms Control Today. For Ambassador Pickering, since the Russians have been one of the obstacles to sanctions and moving forward in the diplomatic path, and you have considerable experience in Moscow, I was just hoping you might explore a little more what we could do with the Russians to move forward.
Okay, so we have three explicit or implied questions, one about the relationship of the U.S. nuclear arsenal to Iran's or other countries' interest in acquiring them in legitimacy. Mr. Piruziasti is about U.S. support or non-support for the Persian slash Iranian people's desire for regime change, and Miles Pomper's question to Tom about the Russian obstacle to sanctions.
Tom.
Sure. Let me go ahead. First, I lived in Moscow long enough to know that explaining Russians is impossible. Secondly, they are an important player and will continue to be. To get them to play on Iran, my view has been that we have to do what I think Flint and I have suggested, maybe in two different ways, but roughly along the same lines. That we have to say there is a willingness on the part of the United States to conduct serious negotiations across the breadth of the issues that divide Iran, the United States, or maybe Iran from the rest of the world. And that we're prepared to put that on the table, but I would say we're only prepared to put that on the table if Russia doesn't have a better idea, and if it hasn't a better idea, and I don't think it does, that it is then prepared to support sanctions as the necessary leverage to make those negotiations successful, or at least to enhance the potential of those negotiations being successful. Secondly, I would go to the Russians, as I would go to others, and to answer the Reverend's first question, which is essentially an Article 6 of the NPT question, and I would say I think the NPT is in difficult straits, that it hasn't failed massively, but it's on the road to failure. And that I would say there are three or four things that we, the permanent members of the Security Council, the nuclear powers, and maybe others, and maybe add India and Pakistan to this, ought to be prepared to do immediately as a way to build a new bargain to strengthen the NPT regime. One of those would be a serious effort at nuclear disarmament between the major holders of weapons and delivery vehicles, something that has, in my view, the necessary inspection control to be sure that it's happening, and serious near-term goals with respect to reductions that would, in effect, meet the Article 6 requirement. The other things I would do is a nuclear fuel regime, and I talked about that, which would, in effect, provide fuel on a guaranteed basis at competitive prices to everybody who needs it for legitimate civil power programs with a comprehensive inspection regime. Thirdly, it is time for us, after 30 years, to have a cutoff treaty. All five nuclear powers have said they're under a unilateral moratorium. There doesn't, in my view, seem to be a serious argument with the need to produce more fissile material, particularly if we dismantle the weapons that we have. It's time to put that in place, and it's time, now that India has committed itself to move in that direction, to bring India along with it. The fourth is it's obviously time, with the North Korean test, to have a comprehensive test ban treaty. I don't believe there is a legitimate need for further testing, either scientifically or strategically. And we're clearly in an advantageous position with respect to everybody else. We have been all along. So why not, in fact, use the opportunity to shut that route off as well? This would be the beginning of what I would call a new commitment to the NPT, an effort to reinvigorate the treaty, and many of you out there could think of many more things to do. But these four things, with the Russians maybe in the U.S. in the lead, since we have to take the lead on Article 6, would be an important way also to demonstrate a commitment to the overall objective of nonproliferation.
I just want to add to that. I want to talk militarily about the size of the stockpile, which is a little bit along the same routes that I was talking before. We will not give up security if we give up nuclear weapons. The United States now has the capability to do as much destruction with small conventional weapons and precision targeting as we ever had with nuclear weapons. That's the first thing. The second thing is I want to take that notion and raise Flint one step, which is maybe we need a grander great bargain, which is what the Europeans have suggested, and I've heard the Iranians say this too, which is let's talk about a non-nuclear Middle East. I mean, there have to be security guarantees. But, you know, these are the kinds of big things that need to be talked about, and there are reasons to go to them now.
Frank, can I trouble you to answer Mr. Peruzzi's question?
Yeah. I accept an assessment that the Iranian people have, over the last decade or so, indicated in various ways that they would like greater openness in their political order, greater openness in their economic light. I do not accept the assessment that Iran is for that reason, because there is a certain level of discontent in the society that Iran is in some sort of pre-revolutionary state and that we can get rid of this regime in some meaningful time frame for dealing with our strategic problems with Iran. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why I think that. Some of them are laid out in the paper. I would just highlight one, that Iranian society is very, very highly stratified society, and there is no single rallying point for opposition to the Islamic Republic. Yes, students have periodically, you know, cropped up and with various levels of intensity tried to demonstrate, express their dissatisfaction with the status quo, and these have basically never gotten any kind of nationwide support, following, reaction, resonance, all of the kinds of things that might indicate that Iran could be in some pre-revolutionary state. And, you know, as far as working with, Iranian expatriates to try and bring about regime change in Iran, I mean, good God, we went down this road in Iraq. I would hope there's some sort of learning curve here.
Okay, thank you. Learning curve. Now, somebody's been very patient. Gentleman back there who's standing, half standing, fully standing.
Trudeau Parsi, National Iranian American Council. I very much agree with the notion that there are rational actors on the other side that can create a stable system of deterrence. But I would like to ask Professor Posner a little bit more clearly, wouldn't it be a tremendous danger, nevertheless, to try to create yet another balance of power system in the Middle East? We've had that for some time. It's been extremely explosive. It's created a Middle East that is similar to Europe between the two world wars. What would be the argument that we would have to go that route rather than going for a regional security arrangement, as Ambassador Pickering pointed out? And I want to say, particularly mindful of some of the voices that we've heard recently from some of the Sunni states in the region that basically want to warning or seeking to create a larger regional war out of the disaster now we're currently viewing in Iraq.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson. Let's take the woman back to the left, and we'll come forward.
Hi, my name's Christine Yorty, and I'm going to ask a difficult, troubling question. Real men don't need nuclear weapons, and Israel has nuclear weapons, and we've not followed the nuclear treaty, and yet we want to have a nuclear Middle East. I'm confused as to how we can ask that.
Okay, and then the gentleman right in front, in the row right in front of...
Jim Loeb, Interpress Service. There was very little comment about the domestic political situation, aside from what the Colonel and Flint said about Elliot Abrams. I mean, the last month has been fairly dramatic. You've got elections, and you have Gates replacing Rumsfeld. I'd like to hear the bureaucratic implications of that on a possible attack on Iran. You've got, from the polls, what seems to be a notable collapse or ongoing collapse of support of confidence for Bush, particularly among Republicans, according to the latest polls. And you have them really, really bogged down at a decision-making level on Iraq, and there's only so much media time they can claim in terms of either preparing a war for Iran or trying to defend what they're doing in Iraq. So I'd like you all, and particularly Ambassador Pickering, if possible, to assess kind of the domestic political situation in light of the last 6 weeks and its effects on Iran policy.
Thank you, Jim. So we have from Mr. Parsi, create another balance of power in Middle East, Christine Noori about the Israeli nuclear weapons in the U.S., and then Jim Loeb's about the domestic political implications. Joe, do you want to start with one of these?
Let me just start with the domestic political calculation. I think before the election, Sam and I were probably in basic agreement and we tracked closely with the kind of reporting you saw from people like Cy Hirsch in The New Yorker. I would have guessed roughly that there would have been about a 60% chance that the administration would have launched a military attack on Iraq in 2007. The election has changed a lot. The power shift in the Congress, the resignation of Mr. Rumsfeld, and with him Mr. Bolton, and then a good portion of the senior leadership of the Department of Defense to follow. I think has changed that calculation dramatically, but it is not zero. It is not zero. And if I had to guess, it'd be something like a 25% chance that because of the reasons that Sam talked about, there would still be a push by a formidable faction in the administration to solve the Iranian problem by military means sometime in the late winter or spring of the coming year.
Sam?
I just want to... You probably want to believe that the administration hasn't been thinking about Iran. The evidence is fairly strong that the second week in October, the word went out both within the United States and with agreement with the Israeli leadership to quit talking about Iran. And it is very measurable in the amount of statements being made and their impact that was taken off the table for the elections. Why did they do that? Maybe not to compound the elections. Maybe it was because they wanted to reduce oil prices. That has all now turned around. Iran is back on the table for discussion in both Israel and the United States. So I think you're going to be hearing more, and don't take the election lull as an indicator.
Tom, did you want to address Mr. Parsi's or any of the other questions?
Let me address the nuclear-free Middle East challenge and what's out there. I think that everyone has seen the Israeli nuclear posture as a conundrum here, and I agree it has been. Having spent 3.5 years as ambassador to the country, it was never and never has been and never is an easy issue. Some will have noticed that Prime Minister Olmert crossed a red line last week, in which he, through some infelicitous circumstance, seems to have admitted the official Israeli nuclear policy. I think that will be readjusted. But in effect, it was Shimon Peres who set the stage by saying, "We will not be the first to introduce nuclear weapons in the Middle East," a brilliant piece of ambiguous circumlocution, which is still the definition of the Israeli nuclear policy, and I would rather have it that way than the Olmert way. I think, secondly, the word has always been in Israel that if we could get a peace agreement, we're prepared to look at a nuclear-free Middle East. Now, whether that's a defense in depth against ever doing anything, or whether, in fact, it is a serious effort to try to take a look at a very serious problem, I have no idea. You can all take your own guesses. I can't inform your guess. But I think that at least in terms of posture, the process is not entirely foreclosed, even if, in fact, the reality at the present time makes that an extremely long, extremely ambitious, extremely dreamlike shot, if I could put it that way. I wouldn't totally dismiss over some period of time the posture, even if only for the reason that almost every country that has gone nuclear has spent more time figuring out what to do with its weapons than it did figuring out how to get them.
Our last round of questions are going to move to the front.
I think there was one question that you didn't get.
Barry, if you will take it on.
Domestic,
No, there was a question about
balance of power.
Question about balance of power.
I think
a regime. I like to cut to the core of a problem. I think if Iran gets nuclear weapons, it's a serious matter. I don't think its neighbors are going to be happy about that or feel secure about that. And I think they're going to be looking for new ways to ensure their security. Those ways involve their own nuclear weapons, regional alliances with nuclear weapons, external guarantees from one or more nuclear weapon states. But they're going to look, and they're going to find something. Now, if I understood Ambassador Pickering's suggestion, he was suggesting that why should it just be one U.S. nuclear guarantee to one state? Why not a bunch of guarantees to many states, which might make it more palatable, less nationalized, less directed explicitly against Iran? That's all fine. That's all good and well. The modalities is a good thing to talk about, and it's a good subject for diplomacy. But I think you have to cut to the essence of the problem. The essence of the problem is that absent outside intervention, a nuclear-armed Iran is indeed the strongest state in the Gulf and will be perceived as a threat by its neighbors.
We have 4 minutes, so we're going to do two questions. Here, the third row.
My name is Tim Phelps. I'm a reporter from Newsday. Would Mr. Leverett expand a little bit on what you think is the motivation for blocking the publication of your piece? And do you have any intention of taking extra measures to get it published? And are you accusing Mr. Abrams specifically of being behind it?
And in the front row.
Hillary Mann Leverett. I'm a former State Department official, as well as Mrs. Flint Leverett. And my question actually goes also to Flint, and it also relates to Well, what I think is important is last week the New York Times actually did publish an op-ed on Iran, and it was by the administration's leading outside expert champion of invading Iraq, who now also takes the stand that not only should we not pursue comprehensive strategic talks with Iran writ large, as you recommend, but he also dismisses the idea of having talks with Iran about Iraq. In his piece, and he also is subject to preclearance restrictions because he formerly was employed by the CIA as well, he actually talks about intelligence sharing between Afghanistan and Iran, but he holds that up as not applicable to the situation with Iraq because the Iranians didn't cause the problems in Iraq that we now have, and therefore they shouldn't really be counted on to resolve those problems. Could you take a step back and tell us about, to compare the strategic environment at the time, what was better or worse for the U.S. between 2001 and 2003 when we were talking to the Iranians about Afghanistan, and why that would not be so useful today?
All right. So, I guess they're both kind of put into Flint's court on this one.
Yeah. All right. Let me take the substantive question first, not least because it's from my wife, and then I'll go back to Mr. Phelps' question. I think that there are some very important differences between the current situation in Iraq and the current situation in Afghanistan, and people like Ken Pollack, or even, I'm sorry to say, some degree Secretary Baker, who are trying to argue about why the Iranians might be willing to help us in Iraq now, I think they really misunderstand this in some fundamental ways. I mean, the argument that Iran helped us in Afghanistan because they didn't like the Taliban and they wanted to get rid of the Taliban is, I think, misplaced. They helped us in Afghanistan because they saw an opportunity after the September 11 attack to improve their relationship with us. And I think then, to analogize that to Iraq and say that, well, they helped us in Afghanistan because they wanted to get rid of the Taliban, and they'll help us in Iraq because it's in their interest to avoid instability there, is really misplaced, because they are very well positioned on the ground right now to defend their interests in Iraq without our help. We put ourselves in a situation in Iraq where, at this point, we need them more than they need us. This gets us back to another point in the Pollack editorial that was just flat-out wrong. Ken said that what the Iranians did to help us in Afghanistan was primarily to provide intelligence. That is just simply not true. What they did was to put at our disposal their extensive connections with the Northern Alliance, including Iranian officers embedded with the Northern Alliance, their extensive connections to important regional warlords, other ethnic and sectarian leaders in Iran, and basically deliver those guys to the table so that they would not work against us when we were operating militarily in Afghanistan, and so that they would either support or at least not block a post-Taliban political settlement. That's what they did for us in Afghanistan. That is, in theory, what they could do for us in Iraq. But they're not going to do it just because we say, all right, you help us because it's in your interest to do it. No, they will only do it if we're prepared to make it part of a bigger conversation about fundamentally restructuring their relationship with the United States.
And Flynn, in 15 seconds to Tim Phelps.
Yeah. Basically, I think that it really is striking to me. I've cleared, 30 pieces for publication through the CIA since I left government, and the agency on its own has never tried to change a word of whatever I've submitted. And for some reason, this week, the National Security Council needs to intervene in this process. And my understanding is that Elliot and others at the National Security Council have become, quite incensed at my criticizing the way that this administration has, in my view, mishandled a lot of issues, their policy toward Iran being one of the most prominent, the opportunities they've had to build on tactical cooperation in Afghanistan, the missed opportunity in 2003. They didn't get to the Century Foundation paper in time, but, they were able to get off the mark and claim that stuff like the fact that the Iranians sent in this paper, which has been extensively reported in the media, it's been talked about publicly by Secretary Rice, our cooperation with them in Afghanistan, which both Powell and Deputy Secretary Armitage talked about publicly, has also been extensively reported in the media. They're saying if I print that in an op-ed in the New York Times, I'm disclosing classified information. It's ludicrous. I'm not going to publish the paper, the op-ed, if it is not formally cleared, because I took an obligation, signed an agreement when I went to work for the government and got my clearances that I would not do that, and I will not violate that agreement. But a pre-publication clearance process that is supposed to be about protecting classified information is being politicized to prevent the dissemination of what are essentially political views, policy views, criticizing the way the administration is handling the Iran issue.
On that note, Flint, if I may, on behalf of what Tom Pickering had described as the mafia of Center for American Progress and the Century Foundation, Cheating Cholne and Laurenti, thank our panel, thank our presenter, thank our moderator.
Thank you.